Well, thank you and good morning. As Randy said, I'm Dave Polson. I'm the Associate Director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State University, where we have graduate and undergraduate programs. We do a significant amount of professional outreach as well. And the roots of this panel, as Randy indicated, are in a National Science Foundation project that MSU has been involved in for the last couple of years. And more recently, with the help of the Society of Environmental Journalists, we partnered negotiating some additional NSF support to explore climate change communication challenges and push for some solutions for doing a better job at that. It resulted in bringing together scientists and journalists at workshops at the Great Lakes Science Center in Cleveland and another one at an NSF long-term ecological research station in western Michigan. At these sessions, we discussed everything from word choice to framing to whether or not the climate change story can be adequately told under the traditional rules of traditional journalism. We surfaced some really obvious issues. There are issues that were obvious to the individual groups, but not necessarily to the other one. Here's one really kind of silly one that just totally blows my mind. The scientists were surprised that the journalists were especially interested in climate change issues when they could link them to human health, which to folks in this room, that's kind of an obvious thing. You know, I was much surprised that the scientists weren't even aware of that. Another interesting thing is over a several-day period, the journalists pounded the scientists in one of our workshops on making the link between individual extreme weather events and climate change. And the scientists repeatedly resisted doing that, just trotting out that old chestnut that we've all heard, that we cannot link any individual extreme weather event to climate change, but under the climate change scenario, extreme weather events are more likely to happen. Then we showed a video produced by Peter, whom you're going to meet in a minute, which showed a significant number of extreme weather events, and where Kevin Trenberth of the National Center for Atmospheric Research says something like, "You look out the window and you'll see climate change in action." So I figured the scientists in our group would indicate that this video went too far. Instead, they applauded. So we asked the scientists, "Hey, this guy finally said what the journalists were pressuring you to say all week long. What gives?" And they said something along the line of, "Oh, Trenberth, he's a prominent and well-established scientist. He can get away with that. Some of us here are still working on tenure." So our panelists today, we have Catherine Hayhoe. She's the director of the Climate Science Center here at Texas Tech University. She's also famously known for writing a climate science chapter for a book by Newt Gingrich, who had accepted it but then rejected it abruptly during the heat of the Republican primaries. Peter Sinclair, who I had alluded to earlier, he's producer of This Is Not Cool, which is run out of the Yale Forum on Climate Change in the Media. You know, Yale sounds pretty cool, right? Really Ivy League connection there. You should also know that Peter is perhaps better known as a producer of the Climate Denial Crock of the Week. Mm-hmm. Peter was with us in Michigan. And next we have Max Boykoff. He's an assistant professor at the Center for Science and Technology Policy at the University of Colorado Boulder as part of the Cooperative Institute for Research on Environmental Sciences. Max did some of the early work looking at how the pursuit of balance in climate change reporting impinges upon the accuracy of that reporting. And of course, we all know that's a long-standing criticism of climate change reporting. But Max has also done some more recent work indicating that this pursuit of false balance is much less of an issue with climate change reporting nowadays. I will say, too, that that echoes some of the research that we've done at my center. Interesting, it's not that big of a deal anymore, yet we still get blasted with that pursuit of false balance criticism. Mm-hmm. And then we have Michael Hawthorne. Michael's is the environment reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He's filling in for Bill Blakemore, who's listed on your agenda. Bill had a family emergency. But Michael's an interesting replacement because he participated in our workshop in Cleveland. And in Cleveland, we had groups of scientists, groups of journalists, groups of scientists and journalists put together news stories and pitch them based upon the same fact set. These were all separate efforts. And the scientists, we had a pure scientist group. They were so proud of their story. You know, and they pitched it really, really, really hard. And Michael was in another group that included journalists and had the same set of facts. And his response is, "What kind of news story is that?" He says, "That's why you need a journalist on your team." Yeah, so much for building bridges, huh? Our format's been described to me as a talk show format, and I guess that makes me Oprah. So we're going to talk about things for a bit before opening it up for questions. Questions, traditional SEJ rules. SEJ members, working journalists, get first shot. Identify yourself. Avoid speeches. Look for a question mark real early in your comment. But we're going to talk for a little bit before we open it up for questions. Please understand, though, that if you want to debate the merits of climate science, you need to find another venue. Okay, what we're talking about here today is climate change communications. And hopefully some solutions for overcoming the challenges to that. So to kick off, got a good news peg. Yesterday, George Mason University came out with a survey indicating that the public over the past 2 years is increasingly concerned about anthropogenic climate change and increasingly believe that is happening. Might not be that understanding may not be increasing as fast as some of us would like, still might not be as great a proportion. But the other thing that was really interesting was 76% of the people who were surveyed said that the most trusted source of climate change information is a climate scientist. And so I'm going to ask our panel, does that mean that we simply need to ratchet up the communication efforts of all these real smart scientists and tell everyone else in this room to go home? And Catherine, I think you got some interesting perspective on that, so why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Thanks, Dave. There have been a number of studies, this is just the most recent one, that suggests that scientists are still fairly trusted when it comes to speaking about the science. But early this year, there was actually a... I have a little bit of an echo here. Early this year, there was a journal article published by two psychologists who... looked at climate scientists and compared them to the general population. They found that climate scientists had a very distinctly different personality type than the rest of the population that rendered them categorically unfit to talk to the general population in general terms. Now, there's always exceptions to that rule, and so rather than wholesale saying it's up to the scientists are not doing their job, you have to realize that many of us picked our career specifically because it meant we did not have to talk to people. But there are some of us who are still willing to do that. So I think that rather than a wholesale, the scientists have to do it, I think maybe more attention to helping the scientists who have that interest develop it further.
But Peter, you kind of use that technique in your work, do you not, in terms of leveraging the direct scientist comments?
Well, okay, the scientists, I started doing my thing because I realized the scientists were absolutely getting slaughtered on the internet. And the reason, I think, was because they didn't know how to speak the language that the internet speaks. Because the internet is basically this sort of squirming, subconscious, paranoid thing that we're still trying to get our arms around. And yet, the one overwhelming advantage that it has is that you can link instantaneously to these generally regarded as believable sources, like NASA, etc. And so if you're willing to go in there and kind of confront people on internet terms, which means get in their face, call them a liar if that's necessary, and then say, here's the source, prove me wrong. And so it's sort of balancing the part of the internet that scientists are so uncomfortable with that overwhelming advantage that it does have. And if you can find a way to do that, then you can successfully make your points.
Okay. But are we spending too much time with the scientists? I mean, this is a political story, right? Shouldn't the political journalists drive this coverage, Michael?
Well, they did for a while, and I would argue they failed. Once the story went from the people in this room to the establishment political media in Washington, especially, it became a horse race kind of thing. And like a lot of other issues, it gets lost in this kind of crazy back and forth that, to me personally, as a former political reporter, doesn't serve anybody very well except the people writing the stories and the consultants that work on those stories. So, I mean, there were some legitimate issues there, right, with the climate bill in Congress and what was going to happen. And if you actually look at the coverage, there were stories that showed what could happen or what companies were doing, what scientists were saying, but somehow it was hijacked along the way, not necessarily in my mind by any one person or one group, but just the kind of the collective weirdness of mainstream traditional political journalism.
Okay, but obviously it's a hot issue. It's a polarizing issue. And when we cover it in that horse race kind of technique, Max, is that, doesn't that help some? Or is it, I mean, are we really fostering misperception?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of things going on. Thank you for bringing all of us together. Thank you for eating your meals quietly and listening. I guess just to riff off a few things that were said, to a certain extent, as it raises awareness in the public space, to the extent that policy actors then treat attention to certain issues as a proxy for pressure to prioritize actions, then, you know, perhaps it is useful. But, you know, just thinking about the notion of language and jargon and essentially communication from science or academic researchers, that this is a big challenge when you're dealing with complex, jargon-laden, you know, probabilistic kinds of issues like we're dealing with here. And so the ability to translate that is rare. And so maybe that's drawn out in some of the studies that Catherine was just referring to, that it takes a rare human, a rare scientist to be able to do that effectively. But that's what drives coverage. I mean, all of you presumably working in journalism communities have to get somebody who can just get to the point, you can meet your deadline, you can translate something that's meaningful and resonant with the public. And that's where a lot of the challenge is. So when we see academic researchers who go into this field who don't who do so that they can do their work in their lab, maybe that's their passion. But in this day and age, this is a fabric of academic researchers' responsibility. So rather than seeing it as an add-on, you know, if I have time, I'll phone back somebody from the journalism community, rather than seeing it that way, that it is a component of one's responsibility. Because to the extent that those who are relevant experts within academic research, we could say scientists, recoil from those spaces, and it happens all the time for logical reasons. Malcolm Hughes, for example, getting his tree ring data research handwritten notes subpoenaed to the U.S. Congress. That takes time. It takes time away from one's lab. But when they do recoil, then it opens up spaces for the not-so-expert or for the outlier perspectives to step in and then happily provide copy for all of you. And some of you become handcuffed trying to still provide this story but not being able to reach those that you want to reach. And so I guess to end around to your point again, raising the awareness, driving that story into the public arena is useful, but when it becomes this tit-for-tat with many outlier perspectives amplified in those stories, one can question beyond raising awareness, are we becoming very misinformed and is this actually counterproductive to some of the goals of decarbonization, perhaps, or comprehensive energy policy to a certain extent.
So it sounds like we've got scientists who are incapable of speaking and other scientists who may be capable of speaking but just have all kinds of institutional barriers over whether they can do that or not, which is, frankly, really good for us, right, Gay? I mean, there's a role for journalists in the world. That's kind of interesting. But I want to talk a little bit about one of the issues that you raised about this extreme polarization, and there's a good strategy. You know, let's just avoid it, okay? Let's not frame this issue as a climate change story. Let's talk about energy efficiency. Let's talk about energy independence. Let's talk about job creation and, you know, all that climate change stuff. Sorry about that. All that climate change stuff. Do I need to repeat all what I just said?
We can hear you.
Okay, as long as you can hear me, that's fine, yeah. All that climate change stuff then just comes along for the ride, and why even raise it? Because it's so polarizing. So what do you think, good strategy for framing this issue, Catherine?
Yes. Oops. There we go. Yes and no. I think that much of the polarization over climate change has come about because it has been successfully portrayed as running against or counter to deep-held values that many people hold. And so the extent to which you can demonstrate that climate change is not about more taxation or more government control or more infringement on people's personal liberties, but is about advancing the economy, investing in technology, improving our quality of life, the extent to which we can do that is very valuable. But on the other hand, if you don't ever talk about climate change at all, then what is your real motivation for doing these things? It's kind of like, you know, we all know what we're supposed to eat and how much we're supposed to exercise, but where does the teeth come in? It comes in because we know what the consequences are. We know that there's consequences to doing these things. I think maybe smoking's even a better example. We know the consequences for smoking. So in the same way, unless we know that the consequences of climate change are going to drive our energy choices, you're kind of proposing solutions without actually telling people why there's a problem.
Well, I don't know if that's true. You're telling them there's a different problem. You're telling them there's a problem that has nothing to do with this polarized debate over climate change. It's all about the energy, right?
It is.
Well, I mean, isn't the issue, too? I mean, if you look back on earlier environmental battles, say the Clean Water Act, that just, you know, we've got the anniversary of the Clean Water Act yesterday. You could see the stuff coming out of pipes going. You could see Lake Erie dying. You could literally see all these things happening. So the river, the Cuyahoga River, is catching on fire. It still took 4 more years after the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in that very infamous fire for them to pass the Clean Water Act, and they had to do it over Nixon's veto, right? So it wasn't like that was easy, but it was easier maybe than what this battle is all about. And, you know, the Clean Water Act affects all of the economy. It required companies to do business differently. Who knows if it would have passed if we were in this kind of more polarized atmosphere that we have today politically. But there was a, you know, you could look back now and say, well, there was this kind of great coalescing around the idea of trying to deal with our environmental problems. And for whatever reason, we're just not there yet with climate change. We don't see it. Some people, they feel it maybe, but they don't see it necessarily. And then when they go to the scientists and the scientists say, well, we can't say that, you know, this drought is caused by climate change. It could just be weather. It could be the fluke. It could be El Nino, whatever else like that. Then people just kind of throw their hands up, including the journalists.
I would just add it. Oh.
Yeah, I was just going to say, before I started doing videos on the internet, I gave a lot of talks, public talks, and continue to do so. So in checking the pulse in a lot of rooms, my sense was that just telling people what the problem is without explaining to them that there are solutions readily in hand, my sense was that you're a lot more successful when you explain what the solutions are. And in fact, there's research out there that says people literally cannot hear you. They will not hear that problem if they're not made aware that there's a path forward. So, you know, just talking about efficiency and renewable energy it has its place. But when you credibly put together the problem with the solution, I think you really kind of, you give people a motivation and then you point them where to go, and that really helps. And so I have this series of videos on renewable energy solutions, which I keep having to fight fires on the climate croc side, but I keep coming back to, and people really like to hear it. They're always asking for it.
Just think about, I'm persuaded a bit by Granger Morgan's take and Granger Morgan's group in Pennsylvania, Carnegie Mellon, who talks about reasons why climate change are naturally just difficult to deal with in the public arena and through reporting. It's a long-term issue that requires a tremendous amount of resources that cuts right to the heart of the way in which we live our lives. I mean, these are all reasons that make it you know, great to be avoided, I guess. But the other side of that, I mean, maybe to take your dieting and food analogy, I mean, if we just did what was easy all the time, we might just be eating Fruit Loops and muffins all day, right? Something like, well, at least I might be, but we need to do the hard work. I think I'll use that deliberately, need to have the courage to talk about climate change for what it is, because if we resign ourselves to talking about what's politically palatable of energy security, we lose a lot when we talk about land use and land cover change. We lose a lot about non-carbon greenhouse gas emissions, nitrous oxide. We lose a lot of the important discussion, and we already narrow the scope of then the possibilities for appropriate action to deal with it. And so one of the things that I have found through my time, I understand, and there's been recent discussion about David Axelrod playing this key role in silencing the discussions within D.C. Post Obama's first, the election for his first term. And there being some fight back because of the reverberations through time, and I think that we can see that in the policy arena as well, that without having the discussions for what they are on climate change, without pushing that forward in the general discussions, maybe outside of our specialist communities, then I think that we lose out tremendously.
If I could just...
Yeah, sure.
From the perspective of a scientist rather than a journalist, the main reason why I would say that we need to talk about climate change and not just about energy efficiency and alternative energy and things like that can be summarized in one word, which is time frame. Mm-hmm. Every year that we let pass without policies in place to reduce our emissions increases the risk of dangerous consequences. And that risk is not a risk that necessarily increases linearly. In some cases, it can be even exponential. In other places, it can be passing a threshold. But every single year that we pass raises the risk of those consequences. And so with energy, we're looking at solutions on long time frames, 20, 30 years. If we go 30 years with no climate policy, with carbon emissions unchecked, we will be facing a world that is radically different than the world we live in today, with some very serious consequences for the U.S. and abroad.
You know, I think there's a real prosaic reason as well. It's in the DNA in everybody in this room. A good journalist can't just ignore an accurate frame and say the better frame is over here. Mm-hmm. I mean, if this is the news, you really have to go after it. Michael, I had alluded to it in my introduction about this little dispute. Maybe dispute is too big to say. In our workshop, and the point was the facts that had to do with the incidence of flu under a climate change scenario. And the scientists were really excited because they came out and their story said was, in certain areas of the country, flu is going to go down dramatically under the climate change scenario. And you said, wait a minute, that's not the story. The story is in certain areas of the United States, the incidence flu is going to go up. Okay, so, but we always say that climate change, there's winners and losers. Do we need to be reporting on the winners more often?
Nobody does that, do they? I mean, I guess.
You're just a negative journalist now.
No, I mean, it's just not. That's for the press release. It's not for the newspaper story. We tend to write about problems, not necessarily do we always come back and say, oh, everything's great now? We write a story. Well, hey, there's, you know, they cleaned up this pollution. Let's say, you know, they've cleaned up the air, but they haven't done good enough. You know, the science always is saying that we haven't done good enough. We're not good enough. We need to do more. Those are the stories that we do. So it is that particular thing. I mean, I think if I remember what I said at the time, it's more like the lead of the story is certain parts of the country could, you know, face a bigger, a broader flu epidemic every winter. It's not that you ignore the fact that other parts of the country are going to perhaps benefit somehow.
So you're going to grab them with the bad news, but you will give them the good news later.
Yeah, that always happens. But my point was that what the scientists at that particular session were saying, that no editor would look at that story and say, oh, yeah, let's go with that.
Okay, but a consequence of that kind of reporting is people feel helpless. And, well, why don't you tell us about that?
Oh,
I was just going to say, my concern is that it feeds into alarmism, because we as scientists are always being accused of being alarmists.
It's a good point. It's a good point. But I think but you also then get into the situation where, I think when you're too guarded or too you couch your terms on what you just said, something that we're nearing this tipping point, for example, but we haven't reached it yet. So therefore, where do we go? Are we cautious? Are we alarmist? When we write about these things, I'm thinking about what Mayor Bloomberg has said. When he was, I think, on NPR. During the summer, and he was being interviewed, and he said, it's a smart idea to start doing things to prepare for climate change. And the Neil Conan said something to the effect of, well, why aren't you building higher flood walls around Manhattan? Because if climate change is going to hit and Manhattan could be underwater, why aren't we working now? And Bloomberg immediately responded, that's on down the line. If we have to do it, then we spend the money on it. But we're not going to spend the money now because we need to spend the money on other things. So it's, if it's not a crisis, is what I heard Bloomberg saying, then why do we need to act in a super dramatic fashion? But, people are taking steps, and there are stories all the time about people taking steps that have the effect of supposedly mitigating the effects of climate change. Those things are happening, and there are stories about them. But so I guess, where do you go? Are you alarmist then by doing those things? I don't think so. So is the insurance policy big enough, I guess, is the question, right?
I think anybody that knows the facts and is not alarmed needs a gut check, because every scientist that I talk to that is deeply involved in this, your statement that you just made, if we don't deal with this, we're looking at a planet that is radically different than the one we know. That's a fairly alarming thing to say.
That is so alarming that it is paralyzing. And myself as a reader, I'm thinking, my God, I can't handle this. I'm going to shut off. I'm not going to hear what you have to say. And I guess, does that play into this? Do we need a broader discussion of maybe not happy news, but solutions?
Well, people need to be aware that the solutions are not as exotic or far away as what they're led to believe. We don't all have to go live in yurts. Did you buy a new appliance this year? It's probably a lot more efficient than the one you had before. So, look at you. You're Captain Planet. Make it more accessible for people. Do you like to shop at the farmer's market? Well, local food, that's part of the deal. People are already doing a lot of these things because they make sense. And what we need to do is just kind of enhance and encourage a lot of the things that are already happening.
Okay. I think maybe we want to shift the discussion to something that we're all dealing with in this room, which is the shift from legacy to social media. Max, you've looked at that a little bit, haven't you? And the implications for communicating climate change. What are the challenges there?
Yeah, there are definitely many. Among them, there is this democratizing impulse, which can be good in terms of more voices in the discussion, but then also you can think of this as just more noise in the system. And to find the signal of information within this flood of stories, this being documented in different ways, how much we're subjected to on a daily basis now. Many of you now probably checking your phones and Twitter and this and that as we're talking. They're
tweeting your comments right now.
Yeah, right. That, this is a challenge to extract that information. There's this, many people talk about gone are the days of Walter Cronkite. That's the way it is. This broadcast journalism with gatekeepers. I think there's a tendency to overly romanticize the past. The past has got a lot of problems. But there is some value when you think about this as not just a simple matter of opinion, right? This isn't a simple political issue, but this is an evidence-based endeavor, at least in terms of the science. The policy, we need to distinguish moving across to decision-making. I think the way in which you characterize it, there is evidence maybe is the diagnosis, and then the movement towards what to do about that, decision making as the prognosis, is a very different set of questions. But in new and social media, the opportunity to get more information is there. I think the practice of maybe it becoming these echo chambers is what I've found, is that folks end up gravitating towards the voices that they agree with and then stay within those echo chambers rather than maybe every now and again going over and seeing what so-and-so has to say, just to fortify one's own view as to why they disagree and why they think that person's an idiot or something. But that said, I mean, what it is now is an amazing, a tremendous new set of tools that is displacing to a certain extent traditional journalism as newspapers continue to struggle. At least in the United States context, the Pew Center has shown that internet consumption for news, national and international news, is on the rise, and that's especially so with younger people who are inheriting these challenges, so to speak.
And those challenges are greater for issues that are so polarized like climate change. Yeah. We've got a short video Peter produced, and can we cue that up and ready to go? Peter, you're kind of like proud of the fact that you don't fight fair. Can you maybe expand upon that a little bit?
One of my operative principles, as I said, I saw that the scientists were getting slaughtered on the internet, and a lot of that was because they would basically port something that was, say, appropriate for a NOVA program, put it on the internet, and then expect that, you know, people would look at the facts and make up their minds rationally. One of my operating principles from the get-go was, this ain't PBS. And there has to be a different way of doing it. And I don't fight by Marquis of Queensbury rules, but I do always go back to easily checkable sources that really can't be assailed or are less likely to be assailed because 76% of the people believe that climate scientists are credible.
Could we show that or whatever magic needs to be done to
bring the lights down,
make that work?
Oh, there it's going. There it goes. Let's start it. Okay. Hit the space bar. Well, you don't know.
Sure. While we're waiting for the video, if I start talking, the video will start immediately. That's the rule.
Okay. let me just set this up a little bit. This is I produced this film this summer, kind of as we were just heading into this major drought, and it happened that I got invited to the National Science event that Dave put together in Western Michigan for the National Science Foundation. And we were right in like early July, just as the kind of impact of the drought was just starting to dawn on people across the country. And there was kind of a sense that I feel has continued through the summer and into the fall that people are kind of waking up to climate change as being evidenced in these extremes that we're seeing, and that these extremes are not something that just hits polar bears, that they hit us right at home.
Okay, and let's roll it so we have some time for some questions. Well, you know, there's something, Catherine, that's pretty as basic as, do we just need to be better at explaining it? Is there room for improvement?
That's a good question. I've spent the last few years really trying to think about what the problem is, because as a climate scientist, you instinctively think, oh, we just need a better explanation. If I could just find a better analogy, a better metaphor, if I could just say it more clearly. And it's true that climate science is complicated. Now, the basics of, you know, we burn coal and gas and oil, it produces carbon dioxide, it traps heat, changes the planet, that's not complicated. What is complicated is how record ice loss in the Arctic could lead to cold winters in the lower 48. How warmer temperatures could increase the water in the atmosphere so that when you have a storm system coming through, you get huge snowstorms like Snowmageddon on the East Coast. That stuff is hard to explain. So there definitely is room for better explanations of some of the nuances of climate change that seem at first glance counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are a lot of studies out there that show that when we are confronted with facts that appear to contradict our values and beliefs, we will reject those facts or we will twist them such that they end up meaning the opposite of what, what they actually do. So I think there's much more to it than just presenting the facts, because our brains are able to take any fact in the world and twist it to mean exactly the opposite if that fits our belief system.
Well, you know, I see that in students who are struggling to write the climate change story that is going to convince everyone. And frankly, they take a very scientific approach to building the story, the perfect story. They got the caveats in there and the asides, and they build it. And they're totally blown away when their parents say, this is a crack. Or when they get it published and they say, this is a crack. It seems like logical science is not enough.
Yes.
And so what is? I mean, what are the hot buttons that we can touch to communicate that type of thing?
I'm becoming increasingly convinced. I have to say I'm completely out of my depth here. I'm a scientist, not a psychologist. But I'm becoming increasingly convinced that we have to show how this issue relates to the values and beliefs that we already have. Those of you who are familiar with my work probably know that I spend a lot of time talking to the faith community, especially evangelical Christians. I speak at a lot of Christian colleges. I wrote a book with my husband, who's a pastor, about a faith-based perspective on climate change. And a couple of people yesterday asked for copies, so I scrounged up all my spare copies and brought them in a box here. and what I see working and resonating with that community is if I can start with the values that we already share, love your God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself, care for the poor, God created the planet and gave it to us to take care of. If we can start with the values we already have and then tie climate change into them, there is no resistance. But if climate change is presented in a way that appears to suggest that God is not in control or that we should love the earth instead of people, all of these feed into the idea that it's opposed to our beliefs. That's just one example. There's many examples of beliefs. Free market libertarianism is another one. But if there's any way that we can show that an issue matches concerns people already have, rather than presenting the perception that we have to root out people's existing beliefs and values, like somehow make people green, that's not going to happen.
Well, isn't it sometimes also, it's like the practical things that end up happening. I'm thinking about a farmer that I interviewed a few years ago. When they had that kind of nascent Chicago climate exchange where they were trading credits and these farmers, you know, they were self-described very conservative Republicans in northwestern Illinois, but they got a grant from the state because they had it's an area that has a lot of dairy farming, and they were one of the first operations that expanded to a CAFO. And so they had some neighbors, some good neighbor issues, what they were going to do with all their manure. Mm-hmm. And what they ended up doing is building one of these methane digesters that breaks down the manure. And then they, you know, generate electricity that way. And then they were getting credits from the Chicago Climate Change. So they were getting this small check. I mean, it wasn't that much. But they said, this has turned me into, you know, I love the planet, green environmentalist.
Exactly.
But what really was driving it was this idea that somehow that they were being good stewards and they were also getting a little money for it too. And they were willing to admit that they were greedy farmers. He didn't like it later when he saw this quote in the paper, but that's what he said, and he was gleeful when he said it. But that was one convert right there, and then
exactly.
You know, other farmers as they expanded out to build more CAFOs in that part of the state.
they all started doing that. Now, there are other issues, obviously, with CAFOs, but that was one way to deal with a number of environmental problems that also led to, you know, at least one community that would you would think would be uniformly almost against any of these issues or skeptical of these issues to actually embrace them.
Making people feel good about themselves instead of bad about themselves is central to this whole problem. Yeah.
Yeah, but
oh, I think we're ready.
You good to go? Do you want to do that, or should we?
Hold on.
Six, seven minutes.
Yeah. All right, go for it.
Lights, no more introductions.
Here is the video of those wildfires as shot by the external cameras from the International Space Station, monitored by the Communications and Tracking Officer and the CRONUS officer here in Mission Control.
May 2011 through April 2012 was the warmest 12-month period in the U.S. since 1895, when the government first started keeping records. In tiny Norton, Kansas last week, it hit 118 degrees, hotter than Death Valley.
By the way, we had 1,800 record-high temperatures in the last 7 days. Make it 108. Are you kidding me? In Wisconsin, it caused Highway 29 to buckle, sending this SUV flying.
The event like we saw on Friday night certainly was very unusual. We'll see smaller scale derecho events. That's these powerful systems that move across very swiftly, just about mowing down anything in their path. But this particular one covered such a broad area of the Ohio River Valley towards the Mid-Atlantic region in a very short period of time, knocking out power to millions of people that have been suffering due to the heat. So they're without power, they don't have water, and it may take a little bit longer for them to have power restored.
Tonight, states of emergency remain in Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, Ohio, and D.C., as 1 to 2 million people are still without power and suffering through triple-digit heat.
We suffered a hurricane impact without the 3 to 4 days of hurricane warning.
Meteorologists say the heat wave made the storm much more powerful. We've broken 40,000 daily heat records so far this year. That's twice as many as last year.
In a normal year, we should have one record high temperature for every record low. So far this year, there's been 10 record highs for each record low.
No parallel. You literally meant that?
I don't think there has been anything quite like this before.
What does this say is going on?
Well, I think it's, you know, you look out the window and you see climate change in action. This is the way it gets manifested.
One of the predictions is not only does it get warmer, but we see more extreme weather events. Welcome to the rest of our lives.
It went for at least 20 minutes. It just pummeled. It was unbelievable. And the rain, there was so much rain. It was like being in a disaster movie.
It sounded like the house was exploding.
There.
You know, just...
To put all of this into perspective, Hurricane Katrina knocked out power, in some cases for a very long time, to about 3 million people. This storm knocked out power to 5 million people at one point.
108 in St. Louis, many areas above 100.
Look at these temperatures. Cities across the country are breaking all-time heat records right now.
Deadwood, heat, drought, you get fire.
It's all the way down the hill, dude.
Look at this. We gotta go. Oh my gosh. Oh my God. Oh my God.
This is crazy. I have never seen anything like this in my life.
The animals are freaking out. Our dogs are going nuts.
Denise, you've got to see this.
Those flames are massive.
What's unusual is to see this kind of explosive fire event occur early in the season. Usually, this kind of thing will occur later.
We always have some wildfires in patches, but we don't expect to see them until much later in the season.
And clearly there's going to be an impact. So I'm not disputing that increasing CO2 emissions in the atmosphere is going to have an impact. It'll have a warming impact. The how large it is what is very hard for anyone to predict. And depending on how large it is, then projects how dire the consequences are.
This corn we're looking at now, should be 8 feet tall,
Right now, we've got moderate to severe to extreme drought over a large portion of the grain-producing area of the U.S.
And what do you want to do to adapt to that? And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting.
Government says the nation's corn crop is in the worst shape since 1988, and it's set prices up more than 35% in just 3 weeks.
And it's only the early part of July.
Dave Ibendahl says his southern Illinois farm hasn't seen a decent rain since April 14th.
Our corn is just about done for. I would expect that the yield is going to be ridiculously low this year.
Changes to weather patterns that move crop production areas around, we'll adapt to that.
And the way things are going, it wouldn't be any surprise to me to see a sharp reduction in the American grain harvest because of drought this year.
It's an engineering problem, and it has engineering solutions. And
people fall back in the face of extreme weather on their own devices, which in places like Kenya and Afghanistan are cheap AK-47s and raiding your neighbor's cattle or turning to the drug trade.
We'll adapt to that.
And this is just the beginning, this kind of summer weather we're having.
Welcome to the rest of our lives.
Here you see the trend, the global trend of the number of loss-relevant weather extremes, and you see that the number has increased from roughly about 400 of these events in the early 1980s to now about 1,000, so there's a factor of 2.5, a 2.5-fold increase of the number of these events. And if we have a look at the different origins of these events, the atmosphere and the Earth, the geophysical events and the weather-related events, then you see a big difference. The red line shows the trend of the geophysical events, and the blue and green, again, the flood and the windstorm or storm events. And you see there is a big difference. You see that they have gone up by far more, and we only can explain this by a change also on the hazard side, which means a change in the frequency and intensity. And as you have seen in the slide before, we definitely have this.
We'll adapt to that.
And what we find is that many regions of the globe are likely to experience this permanent emergence of extreme heat over the next 4 to 5 decades. And in fact, in the tropics, we find that there's a 50% likelihood in many areas that this extreme heat emergence could occur within the next 2 decades.
We'll adapt to that.
Outside of the tropics, areas of the United States, particularly in the western United States and along the eastern seaboard, are at risk of experiencing this permanent extreme heat emergence within the next 4 to 5 decades. We also find that substantial areas of Europe and China face this extreme heat emergence over the next half century. I didn't expect to see changes that were this large. We're looking at what has been a very rare event for our common experience becoming a common event in the relatively near-term future.
And what do you want to do to adapt to that?
Welcome to the rest of our lives.
Okay, I think that's a good time to start approaching the microphones for some questions. Sure, we'll make sure we announce it ahead of time.
We'll
get a hold of that. Let's just get the questions down. We'll make sure we get the URL out to everybody. I do want to make a couple comments, maybe some comments on what Michael and Catherine had to say before we launched this thing, about the resonating with a Christian audience, an agricultural audience. I think, well, that's the problem we have. We got all these audiences, mm-hmm. You know, and how do you do that within one story? Or maybe the solution is you don't do it in one story, absolutely. And you write multiple stories for multiple audiences. Mm-hmm. Peter, but one thing about your video that I find the most disturbing and most effective as a communicator is the "we'll adapt to that," right? I mean, it was a nice little component, except that guy didn't really say that, you know, at those particular points. And so is that not a little deceptive, and is that really where we should be going with journalism?
Sir,
could you speak into the microphone, please? We can't hear you.
Okay. Is it on? I thought it was.
Your question, you just return it.
Okay. The comment I made was that the most effective part that I saw in that video was the "we'll adapt to that" comment repeatedly used. And I was also making the point that it is deceptive because that person didn't say those things after each of the issues that set them up. And so my question to Peter is that may be an effective technique, but should it be acceptable for journalism?
My take is that this is an emerging meme that we're going to see. ExxonMobil has set the tone now. Yep, science is correct. It's going to get warmer, but don't worry, we'll adapt to it. It's just the generic response to all of these catastrophes that we're seeing. And just sort of the idea that, like he said, it's an engineering problem, we'll just deal with it. And as Bill McKibben said on Bill Maher a couple weeks ago, how are you going to compensate for losing Iowa? So I think that's kind of the spirit that I was sort of trying to project there, is that this is disconnected from all these realities. And so that's the crock in this particular.
All right, good. Okay, again, approach the microphones, SEJ members first, working scientists first. Tell us who you are and find that question mark fairly closely. Over here.
Okay, is this on? Yeah. Janet Roloff with Science News. I only had to start covering climate again about 2 years ago and was totally unprepared for the way our audience would respond. And they're a pretty science-literate audience. There's amazing pushback, particularly from meteorologists and physicists. And from what I gather, you can't convince them with the science because it seems that one of the major issues they're responding to is economics. Mm-hmm. So this seems to be, I mean, unlike any other issue, which should be just as polarizing, like a good diet or why we're fostering obesity and those sorts of things, there's something very different about climate that's bringing out very visceral, nasty reactions from our readers. And when I talk to my colleagues here, they're hearing the same thing from other more general audiences. There's something very visceral that people are reacting to, and I think that underneath it all, it's economics, and we're not responding in a way giving them information that's economical or whatever. Does that resonate with you guys? I mean, am I seeing this right? How would you respond?
That's exactly what I see. It's fear. Fear is at the root of these responses we get. That's the visceral response, is fear. The question is, where is that fear coming from? We have to figure that out in order to address the fear directly.
First of all, a lot of those responses are not necessarily spontaneous. There are trainings going on around the country instructing people that whenever they see an article or a piece on climate change, to go there and immediately run down the list of negative responses. And we have this well-financed campaign that has specifically positioned this as a liberal, conservative, free market versus government control issue. And the very fact that people go immediately to some kind of economic argument, which I see in responses on to my videos all the time. Well, you just want to carbon tax us, you know. And so I would agree that a lot more needs to be done in terms of communicating just what the solutions are. And I fault some people in the environmental community for going immediately to this, well, we have to turn our lives upside down. Americans are evil because they drive cars and blah, blah, blah. That has not served us very well. So we need to work on that message a lot more.
Let's go over here.
Okay, Christine Heinrich, a freelancer.
Can't hear you.
Is this not on?
You're as bad as I am.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. Christine Heinrich, freelancer. Relative to some of the things we're sort of talking about here, so much of the reporting, the fact-based reporting, finds itself surrounded by very well-financed advertising campaigns from the fossil fuel industry groups. How does regular reporting hold up against that constant drumbeat of, natural gas is the job creator?
Well, I think you know what you deal with is the actual facts. I mean, unfortunately, the wind industry doesn't have as big a voice as the natural gas industry, but there are more people employed in the wind industry than are employed mining for coal. And when I tell people that, you know, light bulbs go on. So that has to be part of every message that we put out there is people still think that these solutions are some kind of side, you know, boutique kind of science project. Those of us that took the wind tour yesterday know that that is definitely not the case.
Here.
I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star. I have two questions, one simple and one more complicated. The first is, I've heard a lot of good ideas from the speakers there about improving communication. It would be ideal for us if, at the end of this, if a couple of them could give us like five talking points I can take home to my editor when I get back, just to sum it up more, just to sum it up to make it simpler when I go talk to them. And secondly,
Tony, this is a panel discussion, not a news story.
What's that?
Nothing.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Secondly, sort of echoing what Janet says, Railoff, and carrying it a step further, what's missing from this conversation in terms of the political, social, public opinion context of this thing is that we're dealing with the worst recession since the Great Depression. And I have to believe that's a fundamental cause of people's not wanting to go on the front lines to do something about climate change because they feel either broke or economically threatened. And if anybody has any advice on how to deal with that as communicators and how to reach people whose top five concerns are about their jobs right now, I would appreciate it.
First, just let me say that as part of our NSF grant, we are required to put some materials online, so we will have some of those talking points that you're looking for, maybe not immediately today. Anybody on the panel want to respond?
Well, I guess I would start by saying, you know, I think you're absolutely right that the holy trinity of public opinion polling always shows job security, the economy, public health being right at the top. And I think maybe to the earlier question from Science News, to the extent that we're being smarter about framing, about talking about these critical issues within the context of meeting people where they are on these concerns, the more successful we'll be. I think to the extent that we seek to freak everybody out, I think we'll be unsuccessful. So working within the context, the important context of economic recession and maybe a limited ability to take certain steps can be counteracted with discussions about maybe some of the longer term gains, that there are economic benefits in terms of certain steps that you can take as an individual or certain steps that you can support at your community level. And if we start to discuss it in those terms, I think we might be taking a step towards what you're, at least what I interpret you to be bringing up.
I would also say that there's pretty good polling data out there, internet responses notwithstanding, because I believe they're largely distorted, that the majority of people believe that we need to go to renewable energy, that there is a role for the government to support renewable energy, and that there is a whole lot of jobs and progress and benefits that can be had by going that way. So to a certain degree, many of us have been intimidated. I would say the Obama administration has kind of been intimidated or led to believe that the climate issue is not a winner, when the polls show very much that among Democrats and among the independents who are acting more or less the same on this issue, they're very much concerned and they would like to hear, and they're more likely to vote for someone that will express that concern and point a direction forward on that issue.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Clint Wilder with Clean Edge. Right there? Yeah, okay. So Peter alluded to this a minute ago, but there's been not much discussion about this very well-funded misinformation campaign, if you will. Maybe not misinformation, but just enough to sow seeds of doubt about the science, which is what strategies that were used by the tobacco industry for decades to cast doubt on the science so people would keep smoking. And, you know, you talked about Snowmageddon as being counterintuitive, but beyond that, I mean, when that happened, members of the United States Senate said, this proves there's no global warming. So it seems like the whole debate has been shaped, the so-called debate, has been shaped by this, you know, moving the public discourse, say, well, there's still a lot of doubt here. And do we think we can have more reporting on that, what I call the misinformation campaign, or have they already won to the extent that now we can't report on that because that's too polarizing and political?
I would disagree. I think there's been a lot of reporting. I mean, when the Heartland Institute, for example, put up that Ted Kaczynski billboard in Chicago, I mean, there was a lot of reporting about that, and people on their board quit, didn't they, if I recall correctly? And what Sensenbrenner said, if you don't take it down, I'm not going to speak to your group. I mean, there was a lot of coverage of that. It may not have been in every mainstream American newspaper, but it was covered in a widespread fashion. So I think there's been a lot of reporting about the misinformation campaigns and who's funded them. And I recall at one point it was a front page story in the Wall Street Journal when ExxonMobil said they were going to stop funding these groups. And then one or two years later, they came back and said, well, they looked at the records and found that they were still funding those groups, and just not to the same extent. So it's not like that part of it is being ignored. I think sometimes my general sense is sometimes, like the environmental community, they get caught up in these fights, and they're like, "See, why don't you report on that again?" It's like, well, it's been out there. If every story doesn't have something about the, you know, the deep, dark, awful Koch brothers or whatever else like that, then it's some failure. But the story's out there. I mean, you know, if anybody, David Axelrod has made sure that everybody knows who the Koch brothers are now. You had the President of the United States, you know, call them out by name. So it's not like this is an ignored issue. I think sometimes the people who have one particular point of view just want that point of view always being said, and the people who are the well-funded deniers should always be called the well-funded deniers and the big bad meanies. But I mean, there are still some legitimate, I guess, intellectual debate out there. I don't know. Is there somebody out there who's like the Mayor Bloomberg example again? You know, we're going to do things, but do we need to do everything that the environmental groups want us to do right now? No. He's the leader of the largest city in the United States. He's not a denialist, but you know, he's more of a pragmatist, I guess.
Jump in and say I agree. I think that there are stories out there. Of course, there can always be more, and I welcome them. I think where there is a weakness right now, as far as I see it, is within my own sort of epistemic community, within the social science research on these groups, to then help provide maybe news hooks for ongoing reporting that could be both new and be innovative and different. And I think the social science community are starting to respond to that. I can name folks primarily within sociology that have really been taking this up. I myself have gone to the Heartland Institute meetings and interviewed some of the, you know, prominent contrarians to try and understand what are the motivations. Maybe to get back to some of Catherine's points about, you know, where can we discuss points of commonality, points of resistance, and better understand that to then collectively improve our decision making. And so while I do agree, I think the stories are out there, I think that we can push social science to try and understand this better. And part of that is also to fund social science to understand this better too, which isn't on you all, but something that will help, I think, deal with your question.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Sass. I'm a PhD scientist in the health program with NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. And also, I have an academic position at George Washington University in the Occupational Environmental Health Department. So my question to you is, what advice would you give to scientists, especially ones that aren't really well established, in order to preserve their scientific credibility and grow their scientific credibility while also becoming advocates?
Catherine, that sounds like a good one for you.
That's a tough one. There is there's this great group called the Earth Science Women's Network I'm part of. There's 1,500 members now. And there's a lot of discussions on that list as to, as a junior scientist, how can you engage in communication outreach without jeopardizing your career pathway? And the reality of it is that someone once said, a blog is perceived as a charming eccentricity in a senior scientist, but can kill the career of a junior researcher. At best, you don't get any credit for doing these things in your academic circles. At worst, it is actually seen as detrimental, that you're not serious in some way about your career, which I think is really an oxymoron, because how serious are you if you think people need to know about what you're studying? So my best advice to you, just based on my own experience, is keep the science solid. Do good research, do serious research, publish in serious journals, and then that will speak for itself. Nobody can take you lightly if you have the scientific credentials. And that's what we have to do.
Okay, over here.
Michael Fortune, Climate Science Forum. As a scientist and as a writer, I want to ask the science communicators here, how do you discuss large, long-term expansion of fossil fuels, including coal exports from the United States to China, or the Keystone Pipeline from Canada? I recently moved to Oregon. Coal exports are becoming a large issue, and it is not being framed in terms of climate change. For me, it is the primary reason to be concerned about large-scale, long-term expansion of fossil fuel, in that China, there is a lot of money to be made through coal exports, as there are from oil imports from Canada. The issue is being framed in terms of coal dust. That's pretty small scale in my judgment. Noise, bottlenecks with the trains and the boats, all of which I wonder. I have no idea how that issue will be resolved. It could go either way.
So your question is how do we engage short-term attention spans with long-term problems?
Indirectly, but specifically the problem being a large-scale expansion of fossil fuel consumption.
Okay. You got a response over here?
Well, one response is that many people are simply not aware of the kind of self-limiting barriers that there are out there for fossil fuels. I mean, the U.S. Geological Survey has pointed out that the Powder River Basin, there's a lot of coal there, but at a certain point, that coal you can only get at by removing 1,000 feet of overburden first. So the coal that we're talking about that is available at historic prices is actually rather limited. But that story, it's been reported in the Wall Street Journal, but most people don't realize that. The idea that the tar sands are going to, you know, continue on forever as they have is basically a product of $100 a barrel prices for oil. But we've seen that in the United States and elsewhere, we've now reached the price of gasoline that seems to be a critical point where people are looking for other options besides driving cars. You're shaking your head, but the number of miles driven has leveled off. And people young people, are no longer, they're no longer seeing that car as the mandatory accessory that it used to be. Bluntly, you're far more likely to get lucky with your Facebook page than with your ride in the younger generation now. So technology is moving ahead in such a way that we really have to push our utilities and our energy companies to be ready for that moment in the not-too-distant future when photoelectric solar really is going to be more competitive. It will be the obvious choice for a lot of their customers, and at that point the world changes.
Okay.
And we're very close to that.
Anybody else want to take that? Okay, over here.
Brian Edwards Teeger, KPFA Radio. I'm curious. I find that as a journalist, I feel that we've had more tools and better studies come online to talk about the science, and it's gotten easier to talk about the science and address the skepticism. but that a lot of the climate denial money has moved into policy skepticism. So like we saw in the video, people are saying, sure, climate change is happening, but we've got it covered. Or it's happening, but it'll cost too much to address it. Or it's happening, but the legislation that California is considering right now is not the solution. And I find it so much easier to get lost in the weeds trying to explain the design of an emissions credit trading system. Spelling out an acronym like LULUCF, then explaining the basics of climate science, which I feel like even though there are vitriolic deniers out there in all of our audiences, it's relatively easy to get the basic science across to a mass audience. So I'm curious what you think good approaches are towards dealing with the policy, because there is where I see scientific voices conspicuously absent. You know, scoring the policy proposals that are on the table, talking about whether they come close to the level of action that's actually necessary to address what the science is telling us we're dealing with.
Well, that's an excellent question. I'll be real excited to hear the answers to that one.
I think I'll start by saying that that leads us into the much more difficult set of questions around the prognosis. And when one does that, the consensus or convergent agreement that can be so clear and then easy to deal with, maybe, as you're mentioning, is, you know, that humans contribute to climate change, that the climate's changing, and so forth and so on, gets really difficult when you're dealing in these policy arenas. So take, for example, James Hansen speaking about cap and trade in that magical, troubling time just when ACES was in Congress. He was saying he hoped cap and trade died. And people were saying, what's going on here? You know, this is counterintuitive. He said he hoped it died because he'd hoped something else would take a stronger role, like carbon tax. But you've got all of these competing voices stepping in with their say about these policy actions, and I think that it makes it really difficult to try and cover that in a clear way. I think your idea of a scoring system is a great, you know, trial balloon maybe for people to take up here and work on. I mean, there are some groups like the Harvard Kennedy School who's doing a lot of work in the international arena to try to help people make sense of going into the next Conference of Parties meetings. There are obviously the Pew Center, many other groups that try and do that in the policy arena. But, you know, what I am sensing myself and what I do hear from folks like the questioner is that there is a lot more work that people can do to help support the ability of journalists to tell those stories more effectively.
I think we're the people in this room, we're a different lot. I mean, I heard that question and I think, oh my God, that's the best part. It's a million stories, all the policies. You know, then the challenge though is, right, to have a scoring system or something like that, instead of it just turning into what he said, she said, or Jim Hansen says it's bad, and then that's the big headline. You know, why does he say it's bad? And then the actual discussion, I mean, that's the kind of like meaty stuff that the people in this room love to write about. And it's why really it was unfortunate, I think, when ACES, when it crossed over into the political world and the people whose expertise, you know, kind of got everybody to that point in terms of writing about it, all of a sudden, you know, it went to a different desk or whatever else like this, and that was lost. It, to a large extent, and that's just the way the journalism world has worked out. But you know, now maybe we come back to it. You get stories like the one, you know, the series that Beth Daly did in the Boston Globe about how, you know, the Boston area could be affected by climate change, and it, you know, it starts over again. You know, they failed that time, right? It didn't pass the Senate, so they've got to reload and try again to do something, and there will be a million stories to write about that.
Just to add from a climate science perspective, is there any, what metric would you use to measure the success of a policy? The metric you would use is cumulative carbon emissions. That's like all the carbon emissions added up over the century that would result from a certain policy. That's the metric you can use. And that translates directly into a global temperature, which in turn translates directly into the impacts. The best National Academy of Science report that no one's ever read it's called Climate Stabilization Targets. It lays out so clearly the connection between cumulative carbon and all the consequences of our different choices. Written before that report was a companion document, I think, an accidental companion document, a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists called Emission Targets. So if you just Google UCS and Emission Targets, that should pop right up. And in that one, they used cumulative carbon to rank all the different bills that have been put before the House and the Senate on where they fall in the cumulative carbon. So there is a clear metric to rank them, but you have to do a little bit of digging to find it and get it. But at its core, I think it's as easy as an envelope of money for a college student. How much money, you know, do you have steak dinner on Sunday night, in which case you eat ramen noodles the rest of the week? That's the essence of cumulative carbon. Do we blow it all today, or do we wisely eke it out over the rest of the century?
Okay. We'll take one more quick question over here, and we got time for one more after that. So, you, sir.
Hi, my name is Dan Drolette. I'm a freelance science writer. For the past 4 years, I've been living and working in Switzerland for a nonprofit physics research center. And in traveling around Europe, I was amazed at how little climate denial there is, how much there's an acceptance of climate change. You go to Copenhagen, there's enormous wind turbines everywhere. You go to Switzerland, there's photovoltaic panels on every shopping mall. Gasoline is $9 a gallon. They do everything they can to encourage people to take trains. Why is it so hard here? Is it because we're a young country? We can't think beyond a few decades down the line? I mean, you go to Holland, they're building dikes that last 10,000 years. In my native Massachusetts, they plan for a 100-year storm. That's considered the maximum when you're designing a bridge or a culvert or a highway. Is it because we're still forming our country? We're younger? We can't think beyond a few decades down the line? Is it a cultural thing?
Well, Catherine, I think you got some perspective on our revolutionary roots and the nature of that question.
I have a couple of theories on that question. And again, this is a non-expert opinion. If you look at the personality of nations, so to speak, nations can be hierarchical, they can be socialist, communal, they can be individualistic. The U.S. is the most individualistic country in the world, and Australia is number two. And those are the two countries where climate denial is centered. So we are not used to thinking of the greater good, we are used to thinking of our own good, and that makes it really hard to argue climate change. I think that also there's the perspective of the history, like you said. The history of America is a fight against taxation, a fight against government intervention. It's a fight against all the things that make it possible to have the type of infrastructure that they have in Europe. So I think that there's a lot of historical reasons why this is just really tough here. And you're fighting against, you know, 300 years of history and attitudes.
I'll just
Jay says that I promised one question more than I had time for, so a quick one over here.
Can I jump in real quick before you ask that? I do also just want to add on the political economy dimension that we've been asking about, too, is that, you know, the United States founded within this context of capitalism, that, you know, there are pre-capitalist roots to European development, and that might be a little bit of what feeds into the cultural components that you talk about. But this is a big, Ellen Myskins Wood writes effectively about this, about the origins of capitalism and this anomaly of the United States within that.
Okay, very fast.
Well, yeah, related to that, my name is Brian Check with the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And it seems like the goal of climate stabilization is a lot like the goal of biodiversity conservation. As long as the overriding domestic policy goal is economic growth, it's kind of like an exercise in futility. You know, 85% fossil fuel economy, economic growth essentially amounts to climate change. So, you know, we never read about this. I mean, the IPCC points that out very clearly in its
reports.
But the question is, why isn't that a constant contextual theme, especially since economic growth is always and everywhere such a huge news item?
Anybody want to jump on that one?
There are people making money from dealing with climate change. It's out there happening. I mean, I think about Bill Riley, the former EPA administrator, talking about his work on the board of DuPont. You know, they decided to embrace that when whatever that group was that when all the businesses got together and they said they were going to deal with climate change. And with DuPont, it was they were saving money on their energy bills, right? So they were addressing climate change by reducing their carbon footprint. And there are a lot of companies that are still doing that, even if some of their executives might be in the denialist community.
One of the most effective slides that I put up in my presentation shows how Dow Chemical has been reducing their carbon footprint globally consistently over the last 15 years, while at the same time their profits, they're actually realizing $9 billion more in profits during that time, directly related to that effort. So I think there's a way you can talk about this that makes sense to people in our, you know, profit above all context.
Okay, great. If you sit tight, Randy's going to announce that URL for that video in just a minute. A good place for us to wind up. Thanks so much for such a stimulating contribution from the audience, and thanks so much for our excellent panelists.